Goats, he said, scratching his chin. He looked upriver. Jones's tavern boat, the marble company, the curve of the river toward Island Home, the stand of canes tilting at the point, and the dark folk fishing there in overalls and faded floral wear. He looked toward the field again. He counted as many as 24. A small one, tethered to the wagon wheel, stood on buckling legs. A bearded man in overalls came to the rear of the wagon and got something from within and disappeared again. Sutry went in and dressed. The goat man looked up at his approach. He was wearing little wire eyeglasses, and he was reading from the Bible. He went back to his reading, and Sutry squatted by the fire and watched him, the old man's finger moving on the page, his lips forming the words. After a few minutes, he laid the book aside and took off the spectacles, and folded them and placed them in the bib pocket of his overalls. He looked up at Sutry, one eye lightly squinted.
"Morning," said Sutry.
"And a good day to you," said the goat man. "Ain't the law, I don't reckon, are you?"
"No, I live in that houseboat yonder." The goat man nodded. Sutry looked up at the wagon. A large blue sign atop it read, "Jesus Wept."
"Pretty day, ain't it?" said the goat man.
"It is. How many goats have you got?"
34.
34.
Sally died.
Oh.
She never was real stout.
I guess you like goats pretty well.
Well, I've got used to 'em. We've been on the road 14 year now.
How come you to have so many?
Had nothing to do with it. Goats will be goats. I used to have more than what I got now. Didn't have but one kid this spring. I think old Billy yonder's getting too old to cut the mustard.
Sutry looked out over the field at the goats grazing. Three small black boys had come across from the road and stood now uncertainly just outside the goat man's camp and regarded him with wide eyes.
"Come up, boys," he said.
They made their way to the head of the wagon, where a huge old billy goat was tethered. They stood around looking at him.
"Can you touch him?"
one said.
"Why, sure. Just go on and rub his head."
"He won't bite?"
"No. Scratch his old head there. He likes that."
One reached out tentatively and began to rub the goat's nose. The goat sniffed at the boy's sleeve and began to nibble at it.
"He's eating your sweater, Loftus." "I don't care."
He stroked the huge whelked horns.
"Where you going with these here goats?"
"Down the road," said the goat man. "What you wants with these goats anyway?" "Little or nothing. Good fresh milk. God's best cheese."
"You have any other animals?" said Sutry. "Dog or anything?"
"Nope, just goats. I think a feller gets started with goats, he just more or less sticks to goats."
"I guess so," said Sutry. He had squatted in the grass. The goat man's fire puttered gently among the stones. By the river, goat bells clanked thinly in the soft forenoon.
"Say you live right yonder?"
said the goat man.
"Yes." "What, live by yourself, do you?"
"Yes."
"Well, it's got a lot to recommend it. Ain't never been married?"
"Once," said Sutry.
"I had three, and it was three too many."
He squinted his eyes and pinched the bridge of his nose.
"The good book says that there'll be seven women for every man. Well, somebody else can have my other four. What about you?"
Sutry smiled and shook his head noncommittally. He was making a little noose from a weed stem. One of the black boys had come to the rear of the wagon where the young goat was tied, and the young goat reared and tugged at his rope.
"He ain't used to folks yet," said the goat man.
"When will he be?"
"I don't know. Talk to him some there. He'll come around." "Here, goat," said the black boy.
The other two had come to the edge of the fire and stood looking at the men squatting there. The goat man eyed them critically.
"What's your name?"
he said.
"Lonnie."
"Lonnie, you need some goat's milk to chink up the slats in them ribs. What do you think?"
"I ain't never had none."
"Be watchful of them elbows. You don't knife somebody." "Who's your buddy there?"
He ain't my buddy. He's my brother.
He don't talk much, I guess.
He won't say nothing less than he knows you.
You know this fellow here? He nodded toward Sutry.
He's a fisherman, said Lonnie's brother.
Thought you said he didn't talk.
Lonnie looked at his brother, and his brother looked at the ground.
Is that right?
Said the goat man, turning to Sutry.
You a fisherman?
Sutry nodded.
Make a living at it, do you?
A poor one.
It's an honorable trade. What do you fish for?
Carp, catfish.
What do you catch?
Sutry smiled. Carp and catfish, he said. Might catch a drum now and then, or a gar.
Man don't always catch what he fishes for.
No.
You ain't got any catfish today, have you?
I might. You want some?
I wouldn't care to have just a mess for myself.
I'll see what I can do.
It'll be this evening.
I usually run my lines late on Sundays. The goat man turned to him.
On the Sabbath?
The fish don't know the difference. The goat man shook his head.
Can't say as I hold with that.
They sat silently for a moment. The old man smelled of goats and wood smoke. The boys were going from goat to goat down the field by the river. Why did Jesus weep? Said Sutry.
Eh?
He pointed up at the sign. Why did Jesus weep?
Don't know scriptures?
Some.
He wept over folks working on Sundays.
Sutry smiled.
Jesus wept over Lazarus, said the goat man. They don't say it, but I reckon Lazarus might have wept back when he seen himself back in this vale of tears after he'd done been safe and dead 4 days. He must have been in heaven. Jesus wouldn't have brought one back from hell, would it? I'd hate to get to heaven and then get recalled. What about you?
I guess so.
You can bet I intend to ask him when I see him.
Ask who?
Jesus.
You're going to ask Jesus about Lazarus?
Sure. Wouldn't you? Oh, I intend to have some questions for him. I'm going to be talking to him someday, just like I'm talking to you. I'd better have something to say.
Sutry rose and swiped at the seat of his trousers and looked off down the river.
Well, he said, I'll bring you a catfish if I get one. I don't require a big one.
No. It's okay if it's caught on Sunday?
Just don't tell me about it.
All right.
I wouldn't want to aid and abet.
No. Here come some more fans. A group of people were picking their way across the pitted lot toward the goat man's camp.
I preach at 4, said the goat man. Ought to be a good crowd here by then.
Preach.
I preach every Sunday at 4 o'clock, rain or shine. Just straight preaching. No cures, no predictions. Folks ask me about the second coming. Most ain't heard of the first one yet. You be here?
Sutry looked down at the goat man. Well, he said, if I'm not, just go ahead and start without me. He went up the river path toward Ab Jones's. The 3 black boys had one of the goats by the horns and were going around in circles with it, while one of them attempted to climb on its back. A white derelict named Smokehouse opened the door. He recalled Sutry dimly through drink-galled eyes and stood aside for him to enter. How's Tom? Said Sutry.
Tom's okay, said the derelict.
Sutry entered the dim room with its odor of stale beer and the urinous smell of chitlins cooking in the back. The derelict shut the door and hobbled on his twisted legs to the wall where he'd left his broom leaning. Where's Ab? Said Sutry.
Ain't seen him.
Where's Doll?
She's back in the back.
What happened to your head?
What happened to yours?
Sutry smiled and rubbed the patch of stubble hair at the back of his head. The derelict had a massive bandage taped across the left side of his forehead. I got hit with a floor buffer, Sutry said.
I got hit by a bus.
Again? Smokehouse nodded, looking down at the floor, sweeping futilely at the trash. Doesn't it hurt? Said Sutry.
Some.
Some?
I got drunk first.
Oh.
I wouldn't do it without I got drunk first. I got more sense than that.
Well, how do you manage to keep from getting killed if you're drunk?
It ain't easy. That's how come that bus run over my legs that time is 'cause I got too drunk. You got to keep your head about you.
How much will you get this time?
I don't know. They don't want to settle. I may have to get me another lawyer.
What will you do with the money if you get it? Smokehouse looked up from the floor. He seemed surprised by the question.
Well, he said, get drunk, I reckon. At least I won't have to sweep the floor for no niggers.
For a while. The derelict pushed at the trash.
The sun don't shine up the same dog's ass every day, he said.
I hope not, said Suttree.
Things has come to a sorry pass when a white man has to look to a nigger for work.
Hard times on the land, Suttree agreed.
You don't have a little drink on you anywheres, do you?
Suttree had not. Smokehouse had started a new tack when the curtain flipped back, and Doll, in her disheveled housecoat, held out a half-dollar coin.
"Wrong, get me two packs of Luckies," she said.
He stood his broom carefully against the wall and took the coin and got his hat from the back of a chair where he'd hung it and shuffled out the door, his racked body like something disjointed and put back by drunken surgeons, the elbows hiked out, the feet bent wrong. Doll watched him with her one watery eye.
"Morning,"
she said.
"Morning,"
said Suttree. "How's the old man?"
"I don't know. He laid up in the bed. Go on back."
"I don't want to bother him."
"He ain't asleep. Go on."
She held the curtain back for him. Suttree entered a room darker yet, some sort of heavy material curtaining the window on the river, a rich funk of nameless odors. There was a radio playing so softly that he just could hear it. The footrail of the bed came right to the door, and Jones lay in the bed like a tree.
"Who that?"
he said. "Suttree."
"Youngblood. Come in."
"You not asleep?"
"No. I just resting. Come on in."
He raised himself up slightly in the bed, and Suttree heard him catch his breath. "I just stopped by."
"Sit down. Where your beer?"
"I didn't want one."
"Hail, woman!"
He was groping around in the near dark for something, and finally came up with a bottle and unscrewed the cap and drank and put it back. He wiped his mouth with the heel of his hand.
"Hey!"
he called out. She appeared at the curtain.
"Bring this man a beer. Sit down, young blood."
Suttree could see him better. He shifted his huge frame, and so clearly was he in pain that the fisherman sat at the foot of the bed and asked him what was wrong.
"Don't say nothing to her."
"What happened?"
"Same old shit. Your little blue friends."
"Hush."
She came to the curtain and handed a bottle of beer into the room. Suttree took it and thanked her, and she went out again, no word. "Did they put you in jail?"
"Yeah. I got out about 8 o'clock this morning. Made bond. She think I've been out whoring, I reckon."
Suttree smiled. "Weren't you?" he said. The scarred black face looked grieved.
"No, man. I too old for that shit. Don't let her know it, of course."
"Are you all right?"
"Ain't nothing. I got to keep my shirt on. She don't see the tape."
"Who taped you?"
"Me."
"You know how to do that?"
"I done it a few times for this."
"I guess you have.
Being a nigger is an interesting life.
You make it that way."
"Maybe."
Suttree sipped the beer. It was very quiet in the cabin.
"They don't like no nigger walking around like a man,"
Jones said. He had drawn his bottle forth and unscrewed the cap and was taking a drink. "Can you get up and around?"
"Yeah. I ain't down, just resting."
"If you need anything, I can get it for you. If you need some whiskey."
"I know you would. I'm okay."
"Well,
you've got a good heart, young blood. Look out for your own.
I don't have any own.
Yes, you do.
Where are they? Jones wiped his mouth.
Let me tell you about some people,
he said.
Some people ain't worth a shit, rich or poor. And that's all you can say about them. But I never knowed a man that had it all but what he didn't forget where he come from. I don't know what it does. I had a friend in this town. I stood up for him when he got married. I'd give him money when he was coming up. Used to take him to the wrestling matches. He was just a kid. He's a big man now. Drives a Cadillac. He don't know me. I got no use for a man pissed backwards on his friends.
Suttree was sitting at the foot of the bed. He took a sip of the beer and held the bottle between his hands.
You see a man, he's scratching to make it. Think once he got it made, everything be all right. But you don't never have it made. Don't care who you are. Look up one morning, and you a old man. You ain't got nothing to say to your brother. Don't know no more than when you started.
Suttree could see the huge veined hands in the gloom, black mannequin's hands, an ebon last for a glovemaker's outsize advertisement. They were moving as if to shape the dark to some purpose.
I used to work on the river, a Cherokee. Then I was on the Hugh Martin, the H.C. Murray. It had a better store than them uptown. After the First War, there wasn't no more packet boat trade. I was born in 1900. Of a night, you could hear them boats howling on the river like souls. The old Martin had a steam horn could and used to did bring the glass out of folks' sashes. I went on the river when I was 12. I weighed 180 pound then. This white man shot me 'cause I whipped him. I didn't know no better. I was older then. Must have been 14. Dumb as shit. I went home and got better, and before I could see him to kill him, somebody had done it. Cut his head off. Wasn't no friend of mine. Throwed my black ass in the jailhouse. Went up the side of my head with the old clubs and shit. I laid there in the dark. They ain't give me nothing to eat yet. That was my first acquaintance of the wrath of the path. That's going on 40 year now, and it don't signify a goddamn thing. These bloods down here think it's something to whip up on some police. They think that's really something. Shit. You ain't got nothing for it but a busted head. You can't do nothing with them motherfuckers. I wouldn't fight them at all if I could keep from it.
Suttree bent to see his face. Jones blinked, eyeballs like eggs in the mammoth black skull. He must have read his pale friend's look because he said almost to himself,
"That's the truth."
"How did you get out?"
"They found his head. Man had it in a shoebox."
He was unscrewing the bottle cap, taking a drink. His eyes closed and opened slowly in the gloom.
"This man was a gambler and a whoremaster. He never drunk nor smoked. Run a whorehouse on Front Street that was well known in them days. Boats come in, the hands would all turn out for his place. Streets full of whores, queers, any color. Thieves. They come out like roaches whenever you had a docking. Then this feller cut his head off and carried it around in a shoebox with him. He got drunk one night down on Central Avenue and started showing the old head around. Folks running screaming into the streets. Next day I was out."
"Was he crazy?"
"Who?"
"The murderer."
"I don't know. He didn't kill him to rob him. I guess he was a little bit crazy."
"Would you have killed him?"
"I don't know. I reckon I would if that was how he'd have wanted it."
Suttree took a sip of his beer. He could hear Smokehouse in the outer room again, puttering about, glass clinking. He looked at Jones. "Have you ever killed anyone?" he said.
"Not on purpose,"
said Jones. It was dark when he came in from running his lines.
the nose of the skiff broaching rafts of dried trash and skeins of shore light in the Black River. Radio music from a shack on Front Street carrying clearly over the night waters. The slamming of a door. He could see the lights at Ab Jones's, and downriver he could see the fire at the goatman's camp, with the goatman's cart in silhouette and dark goat shadows shifting in the forward reach of light. He boated the oars and stalled against the tire casings alongside his houseboat and stood up in the skiff and made fast. He had a live box made from angle iron and chicken wire hanging in the river by a rope, and he hauled this up and opened the top and transferred the fish from the boat to the box and lowered it into the river again. Then he hefted a small catfish up from the floor of the skiff, holding it by the gills, and climbed over the rail and went down the walk to the river path and down to the goatman's camp. A few people were gathered at the fire. When Sutri came up, the goatman turned as if he'd sensed him there, and he smiled and nodded.
"I thought you'd forgot me."
"I brought your fish."
"I see you did."
"You've not eaten supper, have you?"
"No, no. You?"
Sutri shrugged.
"You welcome to share with me, if you like."
"I don't much like fish."
There's a nice one."
Sutri handed down the fish, and the goatman took it and held it to the fire to see.
"What do I owe you?"
"I don't know," said Sutri. "We can trade it out if you like."
"Trade it out," said the goatman. "I don't know what I'd trade. Ain't got nothing but some picture postcards I sell."
"That'll be okay."
"Postcards?"
"Sure, why not?" The goatman looked at Sutri, then rose and turned toward the wagon. The eyes of the visitors at his fire followed him. He rummaged through his duffel and called out to Sutri.
"How many you want?"
"I don't know. What do you get for them?"
10 cents.
"Well, what about a half dozen?" He came from the wagon with the cards. The fish bowed and shivered in the firelight.
"Take these,"
he said. Sutri took the cards. The cards were old, but the goatman by the fire was not changed from him that posed upon them. "Okay," said Sutri.
"Ain't no need to rush off."
"What makes you think I was rushing off?"
"I don't know, but you're welcome to stay."
"I'd better get on." The goatman watched him. He was trudging out across the field with his chin down so that, withdrawing in the firelight, he looked like a headless revenant turned away from the warmth of men's gatherings.
"Say,"
called the goatman. Sutri turned.
"You know, if you had you a goat or two down here, they'd be good company. You never would be lonely."
"What makes you think I'm lonely?" said Sutri. The goatman smiled.
"I don't know," he said. "I ain't wrong."
It is told first by Ocean Frog Frazier to idlers at the store. How a madman came down from the town and through the steep and vacant lots above the river. Frazier saw him plunging past in a drunken run, fording a briar bush with no regard, and on across the stony yard until he was capsized by a clothes wire.
"He's murdered someone," Ocean Frog said.
The fallen man mauled at the earth like a child, not even putting a hand to his throat where the wire had all but garroted him. He scrabbled off on hands and knees across the dirt, and soon he was running again. He ran full tilt into the barbed wire fence at the lower end of the lot.
"He's crazy," said Ocean Frog.
He stepped to the door and called to him. The man turned. His clothing was ripped, and the shreds of his shirt front lifted about him like confetti in the breeze, and he was covered with blood.
"What are you doing?"
called Ocean Frog. The man screamed, a high, parched gurgle like a running cat. Then he turned and ran again, following the fence, out of the lot, crashing through the crude pole gate, and crossing the road and disappearing in the fields by the river. A few dead bats, or dying, appeared in the streets. Roving bands of unclaimed dogs were herded off to the gas chamber. Harrogate kept himself attuned, somehow fearing that he might be next. One day by Sutri's, he said he'd seen a bat.
"A dead one?"
"Just up yander."
"You'd better go get it," said Sutri. "It's worth a dollar."
It's worth what?
A dollar. You have to take it to the Board of Health. It was in the paper.
You're shitting me.
No, it's worth a dollar.
Why would anybody want to give a dollar for an old dead bat?
They think they've got rabies. It says not to touch them. Just scoop them up and put them in a bag. Harrogate had already started out the door. Hey, Jean.
Yeah?
Do you know where to take it?
No, where do I go?
General Hospital, out central.
Yeah, I know where it's at. That's where they took me.
It was true. Legal tender for all debts, public and private. He had the bill changed at Comer's, dropping it with a careless flourish onto the glass countertop. He took the change downstairs to Helms and got a dollar for it, and changed the dollar at the sanitary lunch, but no one seemed to notice. Already schemes were clambering through his head. He bought a chocolate milk and sat wedged in the row of theater seats at Comer's before a $2 check game and pondered and sipped the milk.
Fucking rat poison,
he said, suddenly looking up through the smoke and the din toward a far wall with wide eyes. People turned to look at him. Cocky paused in mid-stroke at the table, the cue quivering in his old palsied hands. Harrogate rose and drained the carton of milk and dropped it in a spittoon and went out. Rat-like himself, quietly in the dime store aisles. A small box of pellets slid between the lowermost shirt buttons to lay against his skin. Things to be done. The Ford hood that he portaged on his shoulders up the river path had sheltered chickens. He stopped often to rest. It had rained in the night, and his clothes were soaked from the bushes. Scarlet trumpets of cowhage overhung the little house, and wildflowers bloomed up through the twisted shapes of steel by whatever miracle renders grease and cinders arable, and the junkman's lot was a garden more lovely for the phantasm from which it sprang. Harrogate paused at the fence and leaned his hood there. He pushed open the weighted gate, starting a hummingbird from the flowers in the dooryard. Rainwater still dripped from the tarpaper eaves, and it lay in bright pools and slashes on the gray and steaming backs of the autos, where they reared above the grass and fronds like feeding bovines. He rapped at the open door. The cane at the corner of the shack rattled gently in the wind. Everything lay quiet and sun-dabbled in this quaint garden by the river.
"What can I do for you?" said the junk man.
Harrogate stepped back and looked. The junk man was hanging half-drunk from the one small window.
"You remember me, don't you?" said Harrogate.
"No."
"Well, listen. I need a car hood."
"Just a minute."
He appeared at the door, with splayed fingers attacking the matter that webbed his eyes.
"What kind?" he said.
"It's a Ford."
"Any particular year?"
"I don't know. I got it out here if you could match it up."
The junk man spat and looked at him and started down the stoop past him.
"Where's it at?"
He was standing in the yard with his palms in the small of his back, squinting about.
"Right yonder, leaning against the fence."
The junk man followed his pointing finger.
"I hope it don't lean too hard," he said.
He sauntered over to the fence and looked down. He gave the hood a shove, and it fell over in the dust with a sad bong. The junk man looked it over, and he looked at Harrogate.
"Hell, son," he said. "What's the matter with this'un?"
"I hope there ain't nothing the matter with it. I just need me one more."
The junk man looked at him for several minutes, and then he went back across the little yard and entered the shack again. When Harrogate peered in, he was lying on the cot with one arm across his eyes.
"Hey,"
said Harrogate.
"I ain't got time to mess with you," the junk man mumbled.
"Listen," said Harrogate. "I need two alike to make a boat out of."
The junk man removed his arm from his face and looked at the ceiling.
"I wanted to get them welded together and tar up the holes so I could have me a boat."
"A boat?"
"Yes, sir."
"How do you sons of bitches find me?"
"It ain't but just me."
"Oh, you crazy sons of bitches. I wish I could catch whoever it is keep sending them down here."
"I just come by myself."
"Yeah, yeah."
"Have you not got a hood to match that one?"
"I got a 46. It's the same except for the chrome. You can have it for $6 if you want it."
"Well, I wanted to talk to you about that."
He looked like an enormous turtle going to the river, staggering under the weight of the welted car hoods, the aft one dragging a trail in the summer dust. He hadn't found any way to take the pot of tar, so he'd tied it to one ankle and it scuttled along after him. He put in above the packing company, sliding his boat through the grass and down the mud of the bank. The water that trickled in looked like ink beating over the tarred floor. He bent and untied the tar pot and set it in the boat and then stepped in cautiously. The steel flexed with a little dead buckling sound somewhere. He gripped the sides, going along on his knees. The back end lifted from the mud, and he was adrift in the river.
"Shit a brick,"
said Harrogate with cautious enthusiasm. He pulled off his shirt and sponged up the water to better see where the leaks were. Drifting past the packing company, the lumber yard.
"What is that?" called a watcher from the shore.
"Boat,"
called Harrogate back. By the time he reached the bridge, he was sitting in the center with his feet spread before him, taking the sun and enjoying the river breeze. He came in at Goose Creek, paddling with his fingers. Up the small estuary, under the low bridge of the railway, lying on his back. Mud dauber nests overhead and lizards in little suction cup shoes sliding past his face, easing himself along the wall with one hand. And under Scottish Pike and up the creek, standing in the stern of his new boat and poling with a stick he'd found, the rounded prow browsing through the rippled sludge that lay thick on the backwater. He spent the night under the boat, it upturned like a canoe and propped with sticks, a small fire before him. Vestal boys came down to visit and to envy. One among the younger was sent for a chicken from his mother's yard, and they plucked it and roasted it on a wire and passed about a warm RC cola and told lies. He came out of the creek into the river the next morning, rowing with a board and a split paddle in oarlocks made from a dog chain, an eerie rattling apparition stroking through the fog. He'd not gone far before he was near run down by the dredger from the gravel company, just set out downriver. A face passed high up the bank of fog, not even looking down from the floating wheelhouse. Harrogate had stood in his boat and raised a fist, but the first bow wave almost tilted him out into the river, and he sat quickly in the floor again and called a few round oaths. He rowed upriver with his back to the rising sun, envisioning a penthouse among the arches and spans of the bridge he passed beneath, a retractable rope ladder, his boat at anchor by a stanchion, the consternation of a marveling citizenry. At Suttree's, he pulled in and rapped on the floor of the deck with his knuckles.
"Hey, Sut!"
he called. Suttree raised up in his bunk and looked out. He saw a hand from the river holding on to the houseboat deck. He rolled out and went to the door, and around, and stood there in his shorts looking down at the city rat.
"Slick, ain't it?"
said Harrogate. "Can you swim?"
"This time tomorrow, you will be talking to a wealthy man."
"Or a drowned one. Where the hell did you get that thing?"
"Made it. Me and old drunk Harvey."
"Good God," said Suttree.
"What do you think of it?"
"I think you're fucking crazy."
"You want to go for a ride?"
"No."
"Come on, I'll ride you."
"Gene, I wouldn't get in that thing, and it on dry land."
"Well, I got to get on."
Harrogate pushed off and took up his trailing oars.
"I got a lot to do," he said.
Suttree watched him go on up the river, the little keelless contraption skittering and jerking along. It went pretty good. Harrogate turned up First Creek and rode beneath the railway trestle, and continued on until he came to a narrows composed of abandoned machinery and high-tiered tailings of garbage. He wired his boat to a small tree and went backwards up the bank, admiring it. He tried to nap, but lying there in the heat beneath the viaduct with the traffic overhead, he had such fantasies of plenitude that his feet made little involuntary trotting motions. By late afternoon, he was up and about, flexing his sling with its new red rubbers and firing a few flat stones through the light wires, where they caromed and sang enormous lyre notes in the budding tranquility of evening. An addled cock crowed from the black hillside. He looked to his appurtenances and set forth. He emerged from the creek mouth past the curious dark fisherman, oaring slowly and studying the sky. He stroked his way upstream, past the last of the shacks, and as far as the Marble Company. Coming about in the placid evening calm and easing back the oars alongside and taking up his sling. Pinching up the leather in his fingers, pouring the pellets. One flew, and there. A goat sucker wheeled and croaked. He hove back on the sling bands nearly to the floor and let go. And again. Random among the summer trees, house lights came on along the southern shore. The neon night shapes of the city bloomed, their replicas in the water like discolored sores. Across the watered sky, the bats crossed and checked and flared. Dark fell, but that was all. He was drifting beneath the bridge. He laid down the sling and took up the oars and came back. It was a hot night for heavy thinking. He lay with his hands composed upon his chest. Beyond the bridge's arching brow, drifting fireflies guttered against the night, and the wind bore a heady scent of honeysuckle. It was a gray-haired and avuncular apothecary who leaned not unkindly down from his high pulpit. Enormous fans stirred overhead, shifting the reek of nostrums and purgatives. Beyond the counter ranged carboys and galley pots and stained-glass jars of chemic and cotton-mouthed bottles cold and replete with their party-colored pills. Harrogate's chin rested just at the cool stone trestle, and his eyes took in this alchemical scene with a twinge of old familiarity for which he could not account.
"May I help you?"
said the scientist, his hands holding each other.
"I need me some strychnine," said Harrogate.
"You need some what?"
"Strychnine. You know what it is, don't you?"
"Yes," said the chemist.
"I need me about a good cupful, I reckon."
"Are you going to drink it here or take it with you?"
"Shit, if I ain't going to drink it. It's poisoner than hell."
"It's for your grandmother."
"No,"
said Harrogate, craning his neck suspectly.
"She's done dead."
The chemist tore off a piece of paper from a pad and poised with his pen.
"Just let me have the name of the person or persons you intend to poison," he said. "We're required to keep records."
Suspecting japery, Harrogate grinned an uneasy grin.
"Listen," he said. "You know about these here bats?"
"Oh, yes, indeed."
"Well, that's what it's for. I don't care to tell you because they ain't nobody else but me could figure out the rest of it."
"I'm sure that's true," the chemist said.
"I didn't bring nothing to fetch it in. You got a jar of some kind?"
"How old are you?" said the chemist.
"I'm 21.
"No, you're not."
"What'd you ask me for, then?"
The chemist removed his glasses and closed his eyes and pinched the bridge of his nose between his thumb and forefinger. He donned the spectacles again and looked down at Harrogate. He was still there.
"I can't sell strychnine to minors," he said, "nor to folk of other than right mind. It's against the law."
"Well," said Harrogate, "that's up to you."
"Yes," said the chemist.
Harrogate backed sidling down the pale medicinal corridor, past ordered rows of canisters and jars. The rotors overhead sliced through the antiseptic air slow and constant. He pushed back the door with one hand. Belching. A slender rod came sucking out of a little piston. The chemist had not moved.
"You're just an old fart," called Harrogate,
and ran. Sutry just shook his head. He was sitting with his trousers rolled and his bare feet hanging in the river.
"Come on, Sut."
"Jane."
"Yeah?"
"I am not going in no goddamn drugstore and buy strychnine. Not for you, not for anybody."
"Hell, Sut, they'd sell it to you. If I tell you what I want with it, will you?"
"No."
They sat there watching Sutry's toes resting on the river.
"Listen, Sut."
Sutry put his forefingers in his ears. Harrogate leaned more closely.
"Listen," he said.
He waded down on Stinky Point, one eye for measuring the sun's decline, the other weathered out for his friend's coming. He had a pie plate with a piece of high and wormy hog's liver in it, and he was cutting this up in small gobbets with his pocket knife. Sutry came through the weeds, hot and perspiring, and squatted on the bank and drew a small package from the hip pocket of his jeans.
"Here, you crazy son of a bitch," he said. Harrogate's black rat's eyes glazed over with joy. He untied the string and lifted a glass vial from the paper and examined it. A pale label with a green skull and bones.
"Shithouse mouse," he said. "Thanks, Sut. I sure as shit appreciate it."
"You owe me $2.
"Oh, buddy, that kind of money ain't nothing now. You'll have it in the morning."
Sutry watched him go on through the weeds to the river where his boat rode tethered to a cinder block by a length of wire. He turned and smiled back and stepped neatly into the boat, holding the bottle in one hand, the tin of liver in the other. He sat carefully and laid his things out before him and leaned slightly forward and unpocketed the small catapult he'd fashioned from a tree fork. Unwiring himself from the land, he took up his makeshift oars and feathered gently into the current and away. From the deck of his houseboat, Sutry watched the antics of this half-daft adolescent with a mild disgust. Standing amidships in his cockle craft, Harrogate tacked here and there. In the quiet evening, the face of the river grew glassy. Sutry muttered to himself. He'd not muttered long before a bat came boring crazily askew of the sky and fell with a plop onto the surface of the river and fluttered briefly and was still. Sutry sat up in his folding chair. Bats had begun to drop everywhere from the heavens. Little leather-winged creatures struggling in the river, Harrogate oaring among them. One dropped with a mild and vesperal bong on the tin of Sutry's roof. Another close by in the water. Lying there in the dark current, it seemed surprised and pitiful. Harrogate, in his tin coracle, was hefting them aboard with a dip net of his own devising. A bull bat fell bandy-winged, a swift, a swallow, along the dimming shore of broken fence and rubble, and over the sparse colonies of Jake-like dwellings, a new curse falling, a plague of bats, small basilisks, pug-nosed with epicanthic eyes and upreared dog's ears filled with hair and bellies filled with agony. In the smoke and burgundy dusk, they dimpled the face of the river like lemmings. Two small black boys had packed a half-gallon pickle jar with ones they found and screwed down the lid to keep them until needed. In the floor of Harrogate's boat, the brown and hairy mound grew. Strange cargo, such small replicas of the diabolic with their razorous teeth, bared in fiend's grins. By dark, he had a half a boatload, and by the warehouse lights, he struck a landfall just below the creek and tied up. He sat on the bank and drank in the evening calm and the whiny honeysuckle air and waited for the last of the crawling pile of bats to die. When they had done so, he loaded them in his sack and staggered up the bank and home. In the morning, he set out with them. A light heart and deep rejoicing for the fortune of it made the load less heavy, yet he still must rest here and there by the street side. By such stages, he labored out Central Avenue, small and bowed and wild-looking. "What you got in the sack, son?" He peered from under the load at his inquisitor, lounging in the open window of the halted cruiser. He shifted the weight a little higher on his shoulder.
"Bats," he said.
"Bats?"
"Yes, sir."
"What, ball bats?"
"No, them little ones, flittermouses."
The policeman's face bore a constant look of tolerant interest. "Set the sack down, son, and let's see what all you got there." Harrogate rolled the sack from his shoulder and lowered it to the paving and spread the drawstring mouth with his thumbs. A musky smell rose. He tilted it slightly policeward. The officer thumbed his cap back on his head and bent to see. A prefiguration of the pit, vouchsafed a croaker sack vision of hell's floor, deep with the hairy damned, screaming mute and toothy toward the far and heedless city of God. He raised his head and looked at the waiting Harrogate, and he looked at the bright sky above Knoxville, and he turned to the driver.
"You know what he's got in that sack?"
"What's he got?"
"Dead bats."
"Dead bats?"
"Right."
"Well,
what do you think?"
"I don't know.
Ask him where he's going with him." "Where are you going with him?"
"Up here to the hospital."
The officer had his chin resting on his shoulder. His face went blank.
"Rabies," he said.
He turned to the driver and said something, and they pulled away.
Harrogate shouldered the bats and set forth again. He climbed the marble stairs and went past the old columns of the portico and down the hall to a desk.
"Hattie,"
he said. A nurse looked up.
"I got some more."
"What?"
"Some more. Bats."
"I don't know what you're talking about."
"Bats. I got a whole sackful.
She stared at him warily.
"Look here,"
he said, pointing. She stood up and leaned over and looked down. Harrogate fumbled with the sack, trying to see her tits. She put her hand to her collarbone. He spread the sack open, and she leaped back.
"It's a mess of them, ain't it? Get those things out of here,"
she whispered.
"Where do I take them?"
But she had gone down the hall on her white crepe shoes. She came back with a man in a white tunic.
"Him,"
said the man. Harrogate stood his ground. "Let me see what you've got there." He held open the mouth of the sack. The man turned pale. He gestured at the nurse.
"Call the clinic," he said. "Tell them we've got about a bushel of dead bats up here."
She was dialing.
"Where did you get them?"
said the man.
"Just here and there," said Harrogate.
A woman was coming down the hall. The man went to her and ushered her back toward the door.
"Dr. Hauser says to bring them on,"
said the nurse, holding one hand over the mouthpiece of the telephone.
"Tell him we're on our way." "I guess you ain't used to getting this many at a time,"
said Harrogate. They sat him in a little white room and gave him a box of vanilla ice cream. He watched the sunlight on the walls with dreamy content. After a while, a nurse brought him a little metal tray with a hot lunch.
"You can just take it out of what all you owe me,"
Harrogate told her. The afternoon set in, and he grew bored. He went to the door and looked out. An empty corridor. He sat some more. It grew warmer. He lay on the tile floor with his hands cradling his head. His mind roved over store windows. He saw himself ascending the stairs at Comer's in pressed gabardines and zipper shoes, a slender cigar in his mouth, an Italian switchblade knife silver-bound with ebony handles in one pocket, a gold watch chain draped across the pleats of his slacks. Greeted by all, pulling the roll of bills from his pocket. He went back down the stairs and came up again in different attire. A pullover shirt like Fiesel's, dark blue, with pale gray trousers and blue suede shoes, belt to match. The door opened. He sat up.
"Mr. Harrogate?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"Dr. Hauser would like to see you."
They went through three doors. The doctor was standing at a bench among bottles and jars. The nurse closed the door behind him. Harrogate stood there with his hands hanging down inside the pockets of his capacious trousers. The doctor turned and looked dourly across the upper rims of his glasses at him.
"Mr. Harrogate?"
"Yes, sir."
"Yes. Would you just come with me a minute?"
Harrogate followed him into a tiny office. A little white cubicle with glass bricks in the ceiling. Occasional pedestrians walked overhead, muted heels in sunlight. The pipes that hung from the ceiling were painted white. He looked everything over.
"Well, that was quite a collection of bats," said the doctor.
"There's 42 of them."
"Yes. None rabid at all. We were curious. We couldn't find any marks on them."
Harrogate grinned.
"I figured you might reckon they'd been shot or something. Many of them as they was."
"Yes. We examined one."
"Mm-hmm.
Strychnine."
Harrogate's face gave a funny little twitch.
"What?"
he said.
"How did you do it?"
"Do what?"
"How did you do it? Poison 42 bats. They only feed on the wing."
"I don't know nothing about it. They was dead. Listen, I brought one down here before, and nobody never said nothing. They never said there was a limit on how many you could collect on."
"Mr. Harrogate, the city is offering a reward for any dead bats found in the streets. We have what could become a critical situation here with rabies.
That's the purpose of the reward. We have not authorized the wholesale slaughter of bats.
Do I get the money or not?
You do not.
Shit.
I'm sorry. Well, I would like to know how you managed to poison them. Harrogate sucked at his black foretooth.
What will you give me?
He said. The doctor leaned back in his chair and studied him all over again. Well, he said, feeling the spirit of things, what will you take?
I'll take $2.
That's too high. I'll give you a dollar.
Make it $1.25.
All right.
That includes the dinner and the ice cream.
Okay.
I done it with a flipper.
With a flipper?
Yes, sir.
The doctor looked at the ceiling. Ah, he said. I see. What, did you poison scraps of meat and then shoot them in the air?
Yeah. Them sons of bitches like to never quit falling.
Very ingenious. Damned ingenious.
I can figure out anything.
Well, I'm sorry your efforts were for nothing.
Maybe $1.25 ain't nothing to you, but it is to me.
When Sutry called on him, he found a shrunken gin hulked over an apple box, tracing with a chewed pencil stub a route beneath the city on a map of it. A sanguine scene, there by the blood-colored light of the construction lantern. At Sutry's approach, a bright red cat rose from before the lamp and moved away into the dark. Harrogate looked up, feet tucked and bright smile, a diabolic figure across which the shadow of a moth passed and repassed like a portent. How did you make out?
Sit down, Sut. Not worth a shit.
Wouldn't they pay?
Nah. I got to hand it to them. They're smart.
Well.
I'm glad you come. Look here at this map.
Sutry glanced at it.
It shows where all the buildings is, and you can measure it on here, see? On this here scale.
Yeah?
Well, shit. I mean, what with them caves down there and it all holler and everything?
So?
Lord, Sut, it's tailor-made. They're just asking for it.
Sutry rose. Gene, he said, you're crazy.
Sit down, Sut. Look here. The goddamn bank is only...
I don't want to look. I don't want to hear. Harrogate watched him wane from the gory light toward darkness.
It's a deadlock, Sut, he called. I need you to help me.
Beyond in the dark of town, late traffic passed.
Sut?
A chained dog yapped from the shack-strewn hillside across the creek.
I need you to help me,
he called. In the early months of that summer, a new fisherman appeared on the river. Sutry saw him humped over the oars in a skiff composed of actual driftwood, old boxes and stenciled crate slats, and parts of furniture patched up with tin store signs and rags of canvas and spattered over with daubs of tar. A crazy quilt boat sculled through the loose fog by a sullen oarsman who looked not right nor left. Standing at Turner's stall, Sutry stared down into the long glass beer. Little beads of water ran on the heavy, slant panes in their nickel and porcelain mortises. Inside, on a bed of crushed ice, dimly lit and lightly garlanded with parsley sprigs, lay a catfish with a 9-inch dinner plate in its mouth. Old men kept drifting by to peer in and comment. A little card rested against the broad yellow flank. It said, Caught in the Tennessee River, June 9th, 1952. Weight, 87 pounds.
Morning, Sutry, said the fishmonger.
Where the hell did you get this?
Some Indian brought it in here this morning. Ain't that a fish?
It's the biggest catfish I ever saw.
Old Bert Vincent was by a little while ago, said it was the biggest he ever seen personally.
I don't guess you'll be needing any fish this morning.
Not this morning.
Sutry crossed through the market house and went on toward Niggertown with his fish. In the evening, he watched the Indian set out again on his one line below the railway trestle. And back. He hove to in the blue shadow under the bluff and drifted from sight. 87 pounds, Sutry muttered. On his run down river in the morning, he watched for the Indian's skiff. He saw it swinging loosely below the sheer rock of the south shore. Trash hung in the vines all down the face of the bluff, and a thin fault line angled up and switched back until it gained the rim of a cave 100 feet above the river. Up there, watching, was the fisherman. Sutry raised his hand. The figure on the cliff gestured back. Sutry eased the oars into the river and went on. When he came back upriver, the Indian was cleaning fish on a rock at the foot of the bluff. When he saw Sutry, he stood up and looked up at the cave and wiped his hands on the sides of his jeans. Sutry eased the skiff alongside the rock and shipped the inside oar. There was a shallow pool among the rocks, and from the bottom, countless fish heads stared up through the silty water to the streaked sunlight of a world dead to them. Coiled viscera ebbed in the murk, and a few tins gave back a baleful light. "Howdy," he said.
"Hey," said the Indian.
"How's it going?"
"Okay.
I saw that blue cat down at Turner's. I don't see how you got it in the boat."
"Yeah," said the Indian.
Sutry looked out over the water, and he looked up at the Indian again. A tall and ochre-skinned stranger in a pair of busted-out brogans, the sorry clothes, the stove knees and elbows not patched, but simply puckered shut with crude stitching. Pinned to his shirt and joined by their weighted wire, he wore a pair of china eyes that had once swung in a doll's skull.
"I live up the river yonder," said Sutry, "just above the bridge in that first houseboat."
The Indian nodded.
"I seen you," he said.
In the sun, his home-cut hair looked blue, and his eyes were black. Sutry couldn't tell if he was looking at him or just down at his shoes.
"There's the size I catch." Sutry held up the smallest catfish in the boat.
"You want some bait?"
"Bait?"
"Sure.
What kind you got?"
"Wait on me till I get you some." Sutry watched him, sculling to recover the current. He went up the bluff like a goat. When he came back, he handed down a jar to Sutry. Sutry took it and looked at it and turned it against the sun and unscrewed the cap and sniffed at it.
"God damn," he said.
The Indian had squatted on the rock to watch him more closely, and now he slapped his thigh and laughed.
"Shit," said Sutry.
He clapped the lid back over the mess.
"Don't smell it," said the Indian, grinning.
"Now you tell me." He tilted the jar at arm's length.
"Will it stay on the hook?"
"Sure."
"Well, thanks. Maybe I'll catch one of those big mammy jammers."
"Sure," said the Indian. Sutry set the jar on the seat and pushed off from the rocks.
"Thanks again," he said. "Come see me."
The Indian stood and put his hands in his pockets and gave a little toss of his chin.
"Okay," he said.
The next week, he didn't see him. The crazy boat was gone. Sutry tried the bait, but the odor of it, the gagging vomit reek, was more than he could stand. He'd wash his hands again and again after molding it on the hooks. The third morning, he caught 2 turtles, and he let the jar descend down through the dun-colored water behind the last flaring dropper, and went back to his cut bait and dough balls. Monday morning, someone rapped at his door, and he turned out in the dawn chill to find the Indian there. He wore the same clothes, the same shoes, the tandem eyeballs still pinned to his pocket.
"Hey," he said.
"Come on in," said Sutry.
"How you do with the bait?"
"Okay. Kept catching turtles."
"Hey, turtles.
Snappers, hey?"
"Yeah. Watch your head."
The Indian stooped and entered and turned. "Sit down." Sutry motioned loosely toward the dim interior.
"Them is good to eat," said the Indian. "Best meat there is."
"Yeah, well, they're a lot of trouble to fix."
"You bring him to me. I show you how to fix him."
"You want a cup of coffee?"
"Sure.
Have it in a minute. Go on, sit down." The Indian sat on the bunk and crossed his legs.
"I didn't see you for a couple of days."
"No." Sutry ladled water out of a lard pail into the coffee pot and lit the burner. He measured in the coffee. I used to know an old guy who shot turtles down on the river. I never see the meat for sale, though. Yeah, well, I sell 'em sometime. Sutry set the pot on the burner and put the lid on and turned the flame up. He got down the spare cup. It had a dead spider curled in it, and he pitched the spider into the trash and rinsed both cups. When the coffee perked, he poured the cups full and turned and handed one to the Indian. He took the cup gravely and blew on it. He gave off a rich, acidic smell of wood smoke and grease and fish. Sparse whiskers on his fine skin. His arms lean, long-muscled, blue-veined. I never ate one, Sutry said. One what? Turtle? You come to my place sometime, I fix him for you. Okay, said Sutry. The Indian sipped the coffee and regarded him above the cup rim with grave black eyes. I got throwed in jail, he said. When? Last week. I just got out. What did they have you for? Vig. You know. They got me once before. How did you get out? They let me sweep up. They let me clean up, and then they let me out. I come down this morning and my boat was gone. Where did you leave it? Just down here. I reckon some boys took it. Have you looked for it? Yeah. Sutry watched him. Well, he said, why don't we go in my boat and see if we can see it? I'll pay you. It's all right. He got his shoes and socks. These river rats will steal anything that's not nailed down. They might have sunk it. Would it sink? Put enough rocks in it. Sutry shook his head. They went downriver with Sutry rowing and the Indian bailing, bending toward each other at their tasks. They had a hell of a nigger in there, the Indian said. Where's that? In the jail. They had this great big nigger. They fought all over the jailhouse. They'd go in there and bust his head with slapsticks. He'd come around after a while and start cussing them all over again. Sutry stayed the oars. He raised some knots on a few of them jailers, the Indian said. Did he get out? Yeah. Somebody come and got him yesterday. Sutry rode on. They went past the last bridge and down the bend in the river. They watched the shore. That's not it, is it? Said Sutry, pointing. The Indian shaded his eyes. No, he said. It's just some trash. Sutry dabbed his eye against his shoulder with a shrugging motion and went on. You want me to row a while? No, it's okay. They found the skiff awash in shallow water near the head of the island. Sutry eased alongside and laid back the oars. The Indian stood. Is it stove? Said Sutry. No, I don't think so. They must still be here on the island. The Indian scanned the steaming reaches of reed and willow. A plover was crossing the silt bar like a gallery bird. Sutry stepped out with the rope, and they pulled the skiff ashore. There was a little path going up the island through the weeds. They went with caution. Redwings circled and cried. They entered a clearing where charred sticks and blackened stones marked a fire, a few empty bean tins. They walked around the glade. Looks like they skedaddled, Sutry said. Yeah. They can't be far. Let 'em go, the Indian said. Yeah? Sure. Okay. They turned and defiled out of the glade, Sutry behind the Indian. Dragonflies kept lifting from the tops of the reeds like little Chinese kites. What's your name? Said Sutry. The Indian turned and looked back. Michael, he said. Is that what they call you? He turned again. No, he said. They call me Tonto or Wahoo or Chief, but my name is Michael. My name's Sutry. The Indian smiled. Sutry thought maybe he was going to stop and shake hands, but he didn't. They got the boat bailed and afloat, and Sutry shoved it out onto the pale brown waters. The Indian took up the oars and brought it about, headed upriver. What do I owe you? He said. Not anything. Well, come see me and I'll fix you that turtle. Sutry raised his hand.
Okay, he said. Watch out for the cops. The Indian dipped the oars into the river and pulled away. Sutri stepped into his skiff and walked to the rear of it and shoved off from the flats with one oar. The Indian's patchwork boat was soon far upriver, light winking off the sweeps where they'd been broken and pieced back with tacked and flattened food tins. He eased his own oars into the water and started up the inside of the island. He watched for sign of the thieves along the shore, and he saw a muskrat nose among the willows, and he saw a clutch of heron shaws gawping from their down nest in the reeds, spikelet bills and stringy gullets, pink flesh and pin feathers and boneless legs spindled about. He tacked more shoreward to see. So curious, narrow beasties. As he pulled abreast of them, a rock sang past his ears. He ducked and looked toward the shore bracken, but before he could collect himself, another rock came whistling out of the willows and caught him in the forehead, and he fell back in the boat. The sky was red and soaring and whirled like the ball of an enormous thumb, and a numb, gritty feeling came up against the back of his teeth. One oar slid from its lock and floated off. The skiff drifted down past the landing and down past the end of the island. Sutri lay sprawled in the floor with blood running in his eyes. A tree branch turned against the sky. He pulled himself up, gripping the side of the skiff. He could taste a tincture of iron in his throat, and he spat a bloody mucus into the water. He knelt over the side and palmed water at his face, and his face was slippery with blood, and blood lay in the water in coagulate strings. He touched gently an egg-shaped swelling. His whole skull was throbbing, and even his eyes hurt. He looked upriver toward the island and swore murderously. The other oar was floating a few yards downriver, and he sculled after it. Light kept winking up on the riffles, and blood was dripping from his forehead, and he felt half nauseous. He recovered the drift oar and rowed back upriver in the main channel. He watched along the shoreline of the island, but he saw nothing. After a while, his head quit bleeding. Dahl came to the door at Ab's and looked him up and down. "Huh," she said. "What happened to you?" "Some son of a bitch hit me with a rock." "Mm-mm," she said, shaking her head. "Come in." "How's Ab?" She shut the door behind him. Sutri turned in the stale and darkened room. "Why didn't you tell me he was all screwed up?"
"I can't do nothing with him."
"Where is he, in the back?" She gestured him on with one hand, and he pushed back the curtain. At first he could not see him well, but gradually the black's half-closed and swollen eyes appeared, his glistening, misshapen face. His broken mouth moved painfully. He said,
"Hey, young blood."
Sutri heard his breath suck in the quiet. "Hey, Ab," he said. "How are you?"
"I'm okay. I was just slipping me a nap. What you up to in the heat of the day? You catching any fish?"
"Not to amount to anything. Have you had a doctor?" A throaty laugh shook the sagging bed springs. He moved his head on the pillows as if he'd seek a darker place to rest it.
"What I need's with a doctor."
"I think you need some help."
"That might be. But I ain't in need of being patched up and prayed over."
"What can I get you?"
Young blood, I don't need nothing."
"Somebody told me you tried to whip everybody at city jail."
"You can't do nothing with them crackers. They needs their wigs tightened every little bit."
"I remember the last time they picked up Bird and Sam Slusser. You saw cops for weeks all over Knoxville with bandages and black eyes limping around." Jones chuckled.
"I guess as far as that goes, we might look for some this week."
"Ah," said Jones, "ain't but one of them I wants."
"Who's that, Quinn?"
Jones didn't answer.
"How's your little buddy?" he said. "He ain't drowned himself in that boat yet, is he?"
"Not yet."
"He come by here other day trying to sell the old woman what he calls scobs."
"Scobs?"
"What he call 'em. Looked like old pigeons to me. He had 'em all dressed and everything. He's some kind of a mess, ain't he?"
"He's crazy as a mouse in a milk can." Jones chuckled.
"I'm going uptown. You want me to bring you anything?"
"No."
"You sure you're okay?" He turned his battered face.
Do something for me, young blood.
Name it.
Go see Miss Mother for me. Tell her I needs to see her.
Wouldn't Doll go for you?
Doll don't want me to have no truck with her. She won't run her off if she comes down here. You tell her.
What else?
That's all. I'd be much obliged.
Okay. Take care, and I'll see you later.
Yeah,
said the black. He crossed the fields and went up Front Avenue and turned down a steep cinder path past a run of chickens, a sleeping dog. The path went through a locust wood, and the huge bean pods hung everywhere in a sunlight stained and made obscure by wind-blown papers staked out among the blackened upper branches, tents of newsprint and trash, and the ruins of kites all tattered and rain-leached and impaled upon the locust spikes. He crossed an iron sewer main half out of the ground, and he descended into an old limestone sink that had been filled back as a city dump and graded over years ago. Now it was a small glade, and there was a raw board shack in the center of it. Sutry came down the path and out from the last of the trees. The nine-killer flew. A few garish outland birds leaned from the limbs to watch him, gaudy, long-tailed fowl, he didn't know what kind. Their molt feathers lay about in the dust of the yard. He crossed to the door and tapped with his knuckles. It opened on a female dwarf, coal-black in widow's weeds, who wore little gold-wire spectacles on a chain about her neck. Scarce 4 feet tall she was, her hand on the doorknob at her ear like a child or a trained house ape. She looked up at Sutry, and she said,
"Well, you ain't come for yourself, I don't reckon."
"No, ma'am," he said. She turned her head and cocked it slightly. He said, "I came for Ab Jones. He wanted to know if you could come over to his place."
"Come in here," she said, stepping back.
He entered with a peculiar feeling of deference. When she shut the door behind them, they were in almost total dark. She led the way along a hall and through a curtained doorway. Black drapes were tacked to the window sashes. He could make out a table and some chairs and a small cot.
"Set down," she said.
He sat at the table and looked about. She had left the room. Strange effects began to accrue out of the semi-dark like figures in a dream. On the table was an assortment of silver vases and candlesticks and porringers and bowls all covered over with sheets of yellow cellophane. There was a fireplace that held a broken coal grate propped on bricks, and there was a beveled looking glass above the mantel. On the mantel, a lamp, a vase, a marble clock. What appeared to be a stuffed bird. Smaller objects harbored in the gloom. An electric fan on the table kept turning from side to side and washing him with periodic gusts of fetid air. Flowered wallpaper had been glued over the shack's naked boards, and the joints had laddered and split the paper. Everywhere hung portraits of blacks, strange family groups where the faces watched gravely from out of their paper past, hanging in the dark like galleries of condemned, their homemade clothes. He heard the creak of a cellar door. On the hearth, cut flowers in a blue coal scuttle stirred and trembled. He could hear her coming from outside, door latch and the scuffle of her soft shoes. She entered and closed the door behind her. In the light of its closing, he saw a coat rack hung with little fairground birds that swung or turned on their wires in the wind. She came to him and took his head in her hand and held up something small and oddly shaped and wrapped in an old sock toe. Sutry fended it off. "Wait a minute," he said. "What is that?"
"Hold still," she said.
He reared back. In his hand, her forearm felt like a thin piece of kindling.
"Ain't a fool a wonderful thing," she said. "It's ice, boy. Now set still."
He subsided into the chair, and she laid the cold, wet rag against the knot on his forehead and took his hand in her own, a thin little thing you'd remember from touching hands with a monkey through the bars, or having a pet coon. She guided his hand to the ice, and he held it there. A small rill of water ran down his nose. His head began to feel nicely numb.
"You'd better bring some of this for Jones," he said.
"What's got with him?"
He got beat up pretty bad down at the jail last week. I guess that's why he wants to see you.
He don't care nothing about that. He want to kill his enemies is what he want.
Kill his enemies? Sutry had his head bent forward to let the water drip.
Mm-hmm.
Which enemies? Standing there by the chair where he sat, her eyes were level with his. She looked at him. A face wherein lay everything and nothing. A visage hacked from cold, black wax. She gestured with one hand, extending her arm, and suggesting the world that stood beyond the thin board walls and beyond the locust forest, a gesture both grave and gracious that acknowledged endless armies of the unbending pale. That was all. She put a finger in her mouth to adjust her teeth. Sutry stood and said that he must go. She held back the curtain and he went through and made his way to the door. He paused there with his hand on the knob. What should I tell Jones? He said.
I can't make no call down there.
He really wants you to come.
Mm-hmm.
He needs you to come.
I knows that.
Can I bring him up here?
He knows where I'm at.
Well, he opened the door. White sunlight blinded him. Thank you for the ice, he said.
Mm-hmm,
she said. By the time he reached the street, the ice was gone, and he stopped in Howard Clevenger's to get another piece, lifting the rusty lid of the drink box and sorting through the cold water for a right-sized chunk, the smooth shapes sliding about among the bottlenecks with bits of paper and flakes of fallen paint. Gatemouth was watching him from the rocker, and when he raised up from behind the lid and clapped the piece of ice to his forehead, he laughed and wheezed and rocked and shook his head.
Ho, ho, said Sutry. Who went up the side of your head, baby?
Sutry leaned back. On the cardboard ceiling were tacked odd-shaped bits of paper.
Who you jump salty with, Sut?
I ran into a door. Chuckled Gatemouth. Where's all your knot-wagon friends today?
Out amongst them.
Good, said Sutry. He held the ice to his head and went out. Clevenger, slouched in his chair with his arms crossed, opened one eye when he passed the counter and closed it again. Sutry went up the hill toward town. It was late afternoon when he returned. He sat on the porch and watched the river pass. Before dark fell, he rose and went up the river to Ab Jones's. Two white men were drinking beer in the corner, and Dahl was frying hamburgers on the little burner in the galley. He went through the room and pushed back the curtain. The bed was empty. He pushed back the plastic shower curtain on the other side. Jones was standing at the urinal, bracing himself up with one hand against the wall. He was wearing a pair of khaki undershorts, and even in the dim light from the small window on the river, Sutry saw such galaxies of scars and old rendings mended and slick and livid suture marks as made him gasp. He looked like some dusky movie monster patched up out of graveyard parts and stitched by an indifferent hand. Sutry let the curtain fall.
What does she say, young blood?
She said for you to come up there. He was looking at the floor, waiting for an answer. Jones didn't answer. I told her you needed her to come, but she wouldn't have any part of it.
Well,
you want me to try again?
No. Go on out there and get you a beer.
Do you think you could make it up there?
I'll get up there one of these days.
Sutry went back to the front room.
You want a hamburger?
Dahl said. Sutry said he would. He got a beer from the cooler and crossed to the far corner and sat down. The two men watched him. Sutry took a long pull from the bottle and set it on the marble at his elbow. She came shuffling over in her house shoes and set a thick plate before him with a hamburger and some pickles and went back. Hey, said one of the men. Sutry looked at them.
How come he gets his first? He come in after us.
She looked up from behind the plywood counter. Her one eye blinked. She looked enormously tired.
He work here,
she said. They looked at Sutry. He raised the hamburger and took a good bite. It was heavily seasoned with pepper. Rich grease and mayonnaise dripped to the plate.
Hey, buddy, you work here? Sutry looked at them. They didn't look good.